Blog Talk Radio.
It's time for Voice of Indie. Your hosts today are Beam Weeks, author, producer, and marketing monster for independent multimedia publisher Fresh Ink Group, and Stephen Gies, author, producer, composer, and publisher for Fresh Ink Group.
Good evening, everybody. Welcome to another Wednesday evening and another episode of the Voice of Indie podcast. This is show number 78, and I am your host, Beam Weeks, and with me, as always, my co-host, Stephen Gies. How are you doing tonight, Stephen?
I'm doing nifty. How are you?
Cold. Got up this morning and it was 4 below zero at about 7 o'clock this morning, and it didn't get much warmer all through the day, so it's been kind of chilly. How about you down there? Are you still
60s and
with...
sunny?
Cool. Yeah, 60s, I was gonna say.
Yeah, 60s and sunny. It's been getting cold at night, but because we've had these clear, spectacular stars in the sky kind of nights, and you know, real chilly, but it's been beautiful during the day. I stopped and picked up some tacos onto my back from physical therapy today and sat at a picnic table in a t-shirt and ate them. So that was pretty cool. But again, thanks everybody for checking in on me and offering support about my broken hands. They are gradually healing. I can't bend them like I want to, but all the hardware's out now and we're doing the physical therapy. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, it's kind of hard to imagine, like my left hand's not shaped right, and that's a concern for me. And my right hand is not bending and working right, and that's a concern for me. But we're making some steady progress, so we do what we can. But my hands are especially hurting today because for the last couple hours I've been writing royalty checks, end-of-the-year royalty checks. And, boy,
wow.
That hurts a lot. And, you know, normally
just
at the end of the year. See, we pay out royalties, ebook sales royalties, we pay in the quarter that they happen because we get the money fairly quickly. Print books, it takes 90 to 120 days to get the money. So we pay those at the end of the next quarter. We report the sales, but then the money comes, you know, 90 days later. Normally at the end of the year, I zero everybody out and go ahead and cover it myself just to catch them up on their print royalties instead of having them wait that extra 3 months. And that way I can see where we stood for the whole year. Can't do that this year because the numbers are too big. People selling too many books. I don't have the kind of cash it would take to cover the last quarter's print royalties for our authors. So, man, that's good news, I guess,
well,
except for the guys who are hoping for the bigger check all at once. But, yeah, so, and some of these are a lot of fun. Some of them are surprises. The one that's really got me shaking my head is, like, 3 years ago we published The Rise and Fall of a Construction Giant, about a construction company in Fayetteville, Tennessee that grew really big. It was kind of a family operation, and then it got caught up in scandal and a plane crash and federal charges, and the company wound up going under. And the scion of that family wrote the book, told the story. And I saw this as kind of a local, regional, people who are familiar with that company or the history of the area would be interested in it. And it's a big, thick book. I mean, this thing's like $30-something because it's like 680 pages something. It's a big book full of all kinds of pictures and documents and stuff. Very cool. But 3 years later, he's still selling thousands of dollars in royalties per quarter on that thing.
Yeah.
And I can't figure out – how, and I'm thinking of changing like the names of all my books to The Rise and Fall of Another Construction Giant or something like that. But yeah, but anyway, again, thanks everybody for the support. My hands are making slow progress. I'm not convinced yet they'll get all the way there, but you know, we can always hope.
All right. Now, listeners, you got most of you, the regular listeners, you know the routine, but we'd like for you to join in on the conversation, call in or leave a comment or a question on Twitter, and here's how you can do that.
Call 516-453-9902 right now and join us on air, or tweet us with the hashtag Fresh Ink Group in the body, and we'll read your comment or question live. That's 516-453-9902 or hashtag Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah. All right.
Yeah. Now, we've been talking for like 6 weeks now about the Ort Federation. I'm not going to call it Foundation. The Ork Federation to the Stars, the Second Ork Chronicle by Robert G. Willis Croft, which we've been threatening to put out any minute now for like 6 weeks. And I'm here to tell you it's going to be any minute now. We had to send it back to the layout people a couple of days ago. Robert found, I think, two errors in it and something else that needed to be corrected. In one of our back and forths a couple of weeks ago, I told him he was our most persnickety author, and that was actually a compliment. I'm not sure he took it that way, but Freshening Group exists because I'm one of those persnickety people. Yeah. I want to work on it right up until the last second, and I'm not satisfied with it even then sometimes, because there's always something else that you could do to make it a little bit better. And Robert's meticulous, you know. Every time these proofs come back and we go through it, he's looking at the shape of the text boxes and just every little detail and looking for everything to be perfect. And we don't mind. We never squawk about that.
Nope. That's a good thing.
It makes it a little harder for us to predict when a book's going to come out. But, hey, you know, when it comes out, and then we'll just promote the hell out of it and give it our best. But
and when it comes out, it's quality.
Quality, and it'll be right. Until the author finds something else, and then we're republishing later. But, the Ork Federation, look for it. By next week's podcast, it will be out there in presale.
Yeah, and we'll have the book trailer for that is done as well. We're finishing up. We just got a couple of mostly transitions that we got to add to it, and that'll be done and ready to go by next week as well.
So watch for that in next week's newsletter, too.
Yeah. Eerie Charms of Fantasy, Horror, and Mystery by Patricia A. Guthrie is coming soon, very soon. So keep that on your calendar or in your mind. I did the editing on that, and man, what a phenomenal writer. Patricia A. Guthrie is a solid writer, especially her short stories. I mean, she's got a mind. She's got an imagination, and she takes these genres and she twists them and turns them on their heads, and it's just some really cool stuff. So, Eerie Charms of Fantasy, Horror, and Mystery.
Now, would you like to hear the new title?
What's that?
As of a couple of hours ago, it's now Eerie Charms of the Short Story, : Mystery, Fantasy, and Horror by Patricia A. Guthrie.
All right. Well, we're going to have to remember that one then, so. That's what he just said.
we try to quit making changes after the book comes out, you know.
All right. If you missed an episode, any episode of the Voice of Indie podcast, here's how you can go back and listen to them. And you can even listen to your favorite ones over and over.
If you miss a show, find us in the archive, in the Fresh Ink Group channel on YouTube, on Spotify, or under the podcast tab at freshinkgroup.com, beamweeks.com, and stephengees.com. On YouTube, be sure to like and subscribe.
All right.
Got another book coming out any second now, and it's the republication of The Calling Dream by Carlisle Toms. Carlisle's got an excellent book. We weren't happy with our original layout, so we started over and did another layout on that, and that took a little bit of time. And then we got caught in, you know, me having the broken hands, and we kind of log jammed on a whole bunch of projects. So we're cranking them out slowly but surely, and I'm predicting The Calling Dream will probably be our next book that we put out after the Ork Federation. And then within days after that, we should have Eerie Charms ready. So all of these are right down to just the last couple of details, and they'll be out.
Yeah. And we are also in the process of creating an audiobook for our author, Jenny Wong, whose book Girl Wears Those Shoes is currently available in hardcover, softcover, and ebook editions. So the audiobook, that takes a little bit of time, but that's coming out soon. And her website will be up and running. We're still working on a few little behind the scenes last minute things, but that's going to be ready to go soon as well. So if you would like to get the weekly newsletter that tells you all about this kind of stuff, the books that are coming out, a little bit about the authors, tells you all about this show, the Voice of Indie podcast, who this week's author is going to be each week, who, you know, a little bit of something about this author and excerpts from their work. Get on our mailing list for the newsletter. They come out every Wednesday, and this is how you can do that.
Stay on top of these podcasts and all things Fresh Ink Group with our weekly digital newsletter, new releases, videos, stories, excerpts, interviews, and more. Sign up now on the homepage of freshinkgroup.com and be the one who knows what's what.
Okay. Today's guest. I've got a bio here, and I think I pulled this bio off Amazon. It might have been sent to me, but I think I got it off Amazon. And in the first line is the word graduated, spelled G-R-A-T-U. So today's guest, I would encourage you to take a look at your blurb, and if it's over on Amazon or somewhere, and check that spelling, because that one kind of leaps right out at me. But here's the bio for today's guest. James Welpley grew up in Central Texas and graduated from the University of Texas at San Antonio with a bachelor's in English. From there, he collected jobs, working nights in hotels, hanging billboards, driving an armored car, and working as a police dispatcher. He went back to school and earned a doctorate in chiropractic medicine from Parker University. His debut novel, Dancing in the Trap, was just recorded for an audiobook, and the sequel, Tenerife, is set to be released in early March. His style is heavily influenced by detective noir heavyweights Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald. But he also lists Kurt Vonnegut, I'm assuming that's Kurt Vonnegut Jr., Jack Kerouac, and Groucho Marx among his many inspirations. Now, did I say Tenerife correctly?
I think it's Tenerife, but
Tenerife.
I don't know that for sure.
Well, welcome to the show, James.
Welcome, James.
Thank you for having me. And for calling
so,
me
So, James.
Spellings on my bio, come on.
Oh, I'm telling you, we are persnickety over here at Fresh Ink Group. Yep.
We pick these things apart.
We're all editors. We can't drive down the road and read road signs without, you know, wanting to correct them.
So you grew up in Central Texas? Is this where you
lived
your whole life?
Born in Fairfax. Pretty much. Born in Fairfax, Virginia, but I had my second birthday here in Central Texas, so I really don't know anywhere else.
Ah, okay. Never lived anywhere else outside of Texas or Virginia?
For a very, very short time, I thought I'd try out my sea legs, trying to become a commercial fisherman in the Boston area. I wound up in Point Judith, Rhode Island, on a lobster boat before I figured, you know, this probably isn't for me. So came home and been to Texas ever since.
Lobster in Boston.
Yeah. Exactly.
All right, one of my favorite cities.
So what's it like around where you're living now there in Texas? Is it like suburbs? Are you kind of out in the country? You in the city? You got a condo? You're living in a tree? What's going on?
My wife and I just bought a nice little house here in a little town of New Braunfels, Texas, which is probably most famous for Schlitterbahn. And we have one of the more famous dance halls in probably all the United States, Green Hall, which is right down the road from us. So between Austin and San Antonio, a nice little spot there on the I-35 corridor.
Now, Schlitterbahn, you're talking about a water park, or you're
the
talking about a specific
park,
ride?
Yes,
okay, so the name of the park.
Oh, no, the whole thing. It's like Schlitterbahn is here, like right in the center of town. It's you know, four blocks from my house. it kind of dominates the space.
I'll bet.
Now, growing up in Texas, what kind of childhood did you have? Did you get good grades? Were you into reading and writing at a young age, or did this come to you later?
Yeah, it really came to me later. I had a normal school experience, although, you know, in first grade they started pulling, you know, eight of us out to be in what they called the talented and gifted, and kind of rode those classes all the way through to high school. And you know, went to college for 4 years, and it really wasn't until I graduated from college and I no longer had to read that I really started enjoying reading. You know, I got my English degree, and you know, the last few years of school where I was heavy into poetry. Both my senior symposiums were on poetry and Western American literature, South American poetry of like Pablo Neruda and Greek classics. I took Greek classics and Roman classics and Christian classics, all just to satisfy all those literary credits, and that's the things that I've really held on to. But again, it wasn't until I got out of school that I really just started to love reading when the pressure was off and I didn't, you know, have to have Gulliver's Travels read by Thursday. Trying to open up, and I found a newspaper article. It was like the New York Review of Books or whatever, I think, put out like the top 100 novels ever written. And looking at the list, I'd already read like 30 of them. So I'm like, I'm just going to kill the rest of this list off. And I just started reading voraciously. But, you know, when I didn't quite finish that list because I found Raymond Chandler and kind of the detective noir genre of books. And that's really, it's like I don't want to read anything else. I try really hard and I get, you know, 100 pages into something. And I'm like, I could be reading Ross McDonald for the third time. But, you know, it really inspired me to write.
That's cool. Beam, you want to go ahead and run our first commercial?
Sure thing.
This one will be for the Orc Federation, which, as Beam mentioned earlier, the video is down to just a couple of transitions, so we'll probably have that up in the next day or two over on YouTube.
As the Orc Federation becomes a major force in the solar system, Braxton Thorpe passes the Federation chairmanship to former U.S. President John Butler. Thorpe's group offers humanity virtual immortality, but Isidore Orlov and his Udakhni Enterprises oppose their every move. While terraforming Mars for more living space, the Mars Reds prove formidable as resistors. If the Asterian Starship fighter pilots are released, will they align with Phoenix or Udakhni? And who will develop the right FTL technology? In this tense space adventure, Thorpe, his team, and Max the Tabby Cat travel to Proxima Centauri and beyond to the Aster system, 84 light years distant. Will Thorpe bring together humans and Asterians in their quest for intergalactic travel? Will long life prove more than mere humans can handle? Grab Icicle, a Tensor Matrix, the first Oort Chronicle, and continue the journey with the Oort Federation to the stars. Proudly published in all print, digital, and sensory-enhanced audiobook by Fresh Ink Group.
Yeah.
Now watch for that in a couple of days on YouTube. And hey, subscribe to the Fresh Ink Group channel while you're over there. I'm telling you, we just get happy. We just get up and dance when we see new subscribers over there.
Now, Udakhni sounds like a quarterback for the Rams.
So what's going on Twitter, Mr. Weeks?
We have a few comments here. Speaking of Udakhni and the Oort Chronicles, Robert G. Willis-Croft says, talking about the weather, in Denver we started out at 15 and rose to 46 and are now back to 32. Well, we had a high of 18 today. Marlena, she's promoting the show. She says, join the fellows of Voice of India as they chat with author James Welpley live now. Thank you, Marlena. We appreciate that.
Thank you, Marlena.
And Robert G. Willis-Croft also says, whoa, I felt honored when we were talking about his work earlier.
Persnicketiness.
And Dr. Helen Burrell, she says, very interesting. A multi-talent's ultimate education makes him doctor. That's not all, because he's all that. Dr. James Welpley, salute this English major, BA, chiropractor DC, and gifted writer of Dancing in the Trap.
And she put the book cover up and the link for people who want to get over there and buy. So great.
And Robert G. Willis-Croft, one last comment. He says, I'm a great fan of those old detective novels and their knockoff movies and TV shows. All right.
Yeah, definitely. So, James, are you a practicing chiropractor now? You have a practice?
I'm not. I practiced for 4 years, and I really just didn't have the mentality for it, I think. The guy I worked for is kind of funny. I moved down here to San Antonio to work for him, and after about a year, he said, you know, you're too nice to your patients. They like you too much. And I'm like, that doesn't sound like a bad thing. And he's like, no, they feel like they don't have to come to their appointments because Dr. J is going to be cool with it. He's going to understand. And it was true. I mean, I got invited to like birthday parties and gymnastics recital, gymnastics competitions, and like all these things, and I was going to those, and you know, but I had a hard time getting patients to stick to a treatment plan. So,
that's kind of weird.
In the same line of, you know, go ahead.
I was going to say, you think the familiarity would make them respect you more and make them want to show the respect, you know, as opposed to it's easy not to show up to some stranger's appointment, but not the guy you know.
That's that was his take on it. You know what? In hindsight, I think I had to agree with him. So yeah, yeah.
All right. Well, let us know when the next birthday party is. We'll be there.
So James, tell us a little bit about your family. You married? You have kids? Grandkids?
Married. I was very lucky and married my best friend and my soulmate. We just celebrated our 7th wedding anniversary. She gave me
congratulations.
A wonderful, beautiful stepdaughter, Fiona, who just graduated from college, and she's kind of out in the world now, which is terrifying.
Congratulations, Fiona. Big
yeah,
accomplishment.
Congratulations.
Yeah, so it's good times right now. I can't complain.
Now, since you're not doing the chiropractic, what is your day job? Or do you write full-time?
Oh, I wish I wrote full-time. If I wrote full-time, there would be like a book a month coming out. I actually work for the Texas Department of Insurance. In a regulatory capacity, so I'm a proud bureaucrat.
Wow, I got goosebumps when you said that. Say it again.
Bureaucrat. Yeah, not as much fun stories as being a police dispatcher, but it's a good job.
Yeah,
I love working.
I bet there's some stories there. Well, what about how you spend the rest of your time? You got hobbies, interests, you health? You like to go out and run? You're a bowling aficionado? What are you into?
Man, I would not run if the devil was chasing me. I just started gardening, and gardening has been like the funnest thing. And it's ridiculous because I fill up my Instagram with pictures of vegetables, and people are like, stop taking pictures of tomatoes. But, yeah, but we had a cold snap here. It was like 30 for 3 days in a row. Everything's dead. So I get to just wait until we get our last frost sometime probably in February, and then I can replant.
So what are
like
you
how
growing?
I like how you call 30 a cold snap.
Yeah.
Oh, I know you guys are
spring here.
So in Texas, you got polar
here.
Bears rooting through our trash here when it's 30.
Of course, our utilities work, you know.
Oh.
So what are you growing? I mean, what's in this garden? You got snap peas, you got pumpkins. What are you into?
Well, I had my winter garden out, so I was trying to grow broccoli and cauliflower, Brussels sprouts, had some cabbage and kale. I got like a tiny baseball-sized head of purple cabbage out of it. And two horribly frostbitten cauliflower florets.
Well, they tasted good.
They were delicious.
They are delicious. Now, you've mentioned that when you were in school, you didn't start reading, you know, for enjoyment until after you got out of school. When did you start writing, and how long have you been writing?
I started writing probably around 95 or 96. And funny thing is I've had the first 5 chapters of Dancing in the Trap for probably 10 years, and I hadn't done anything with them. And then I moved here to New Braunfels, and me and my wife were just walking through the library, and she noticed on a billboard, she's like, hey, there's a writer's group that meets, and they're like meeting right now. She's like, why don't you go in there and introduce yourself? And so it was really with her prompting that I walked into this room full of very talented writers, and they really pushed me and supported me, and I started churning out, you know, a chapter a month, and in probably 8 months after, you know, sitting on those 5 chapters for 10 years, you know, in 8 months I had a book, and I just, I owe them greatly, and I dedicated, you know, the first page to them, and as well as my wife, and they've been fantastic. We don't agree on everything, but even the parts that we don't agree on wind up being like the best purpose for having like a group of people like that, that you can bounce ideas off of, and who can kind of call you when you're forcing something or when something's overwritten. They've been a fantastic resource and have become great friends.
So how did that come about?
How did that, what I'm sorry?
How'd you hook up with these people? How did this come about?
Again, it was just walking into the library. We were at the library, and my wife saw a sign. They were meeting in a conference room. I literally just walked in there.
You just wandered into a meeting. Cool.
Yeah, they're just it's a small group. There's only, you know, 10 of us, I think, at our greatest, and we've been whittled down considerably with COVID, but we are still meeting regularly.
Hey, 10's a good group. Patricia A. Guthrie, one of our writers who just put out Legacy of Danger, just moved to a new community, and she wanted to start a writing class. So she put out posters and put out a bunch of stuff, and one person signed up. So she said, we have fun every week, just the two of us. So that's all it takes.
That's great.
You get
a lot of first, we got a tweet on here from Verwayne Greenhall. He jumped in here. He said, we've been listening from the beginning, but why is it everyone wants to call or email me right at 8:01. I have invited my friends to blogit.com to join the audience. I have been a member since 2002, and I love it and them. It's good to be here. Well, welcome, Verwayne and Lisa. And blogit.com, Verwayne shares this podcast over there, I believe. So that's cool.
Yeah, definitely cool. Yeah, We don't like it when people share our podcast, you know, because who wants an audience, you know? So, yeah, we definitely appreciate that, Verwayne. Especially,
I was going to be upset if Verwayne didn't chime in.
Yeah, especially especially long term, too, because, you know, we have a good audience that's out there live participating. A lot of them are being quiet. Some of them speak up every week. But the numbers really start going up after a couple of weeks of being in the archives. People are finding them. And the search engines, especially Google, seem to be really liking our podcast. Virtually everybody we've interviewed, if you Google that author's name, that podcast appearance with that author is showing up on the first page of results. So if you're lucky enough to have been one of the great guests on this cool podcast, keep sharing your episode for years to come, because that's a lot of information about you, the author, and your fans are interested in it, and it helps get the word out.
Yeah, definitely. Now, James, the whole idea of taking 10 years on that book is not that shocking. My first novel was 8 years in the making from start to finish, but there was 2 years where it sat in a cupboard and nothing got done with it. And I actually hear from other authors, and some of them are even longer than that, you know, 12, 15 years. You know, then they finally released the book. How has your writing evolved since you first started writing that? Now, because 10 years, there's going to be an evolution there. Is there a cohesion, or did you have to go back and maybe tighten up those first chapters that you wrote 10 years ago?
Honestly, I didn't really have to touch much in those chapters. It was like they were almost like a writing prompt. Because I think my voice and my style, I'm almost afraid that I can't write in another way. I mean, anyone that reads like the first chapter of my book, they're going to see what my writing's about. They're going to be like, oh, this guy, you know, likes analogies and likes kind of that fast detective speak style. And it really wasn't. I think that's why I latched on to Raymond Chandler so much when I first read him. Killer in the Rain was just a collection of short stories, the first thing I ever read. And I couldn't stop reading it. And because it's like I heard myself, and I heard like those old almost comedic rhythms that I loved growing up, like being obsessed with Bugs Bunny and Groucho Marx and like vaudeville. I love Jackie Mason. I love like that rhythm and the timing.
Jackie Mason.
Who doesn't love Jackie Mason? He is just forgotten and shouldn't be. But... you know, I loved all those things, and I heard that in Raymond Chandler, and, like, I wanted to – that's how it kind of it came out for me, and so that's my voice. So I think I have a strong style, and it really didn't change with that gap. So I got lucky.
That's interesting. It really is. Because, I mean, I can look at stuff that I wrote. You know, I've got two short story collections, and there's 39 stories between the two books. And some of these stories are, you know, written 20 years ago. And I can see there's a little bit of a change as I go along, you know, each passing 3 or 4 years, you know, learning something new, a new technique, and adding that into there or whatever. So there's a little difference between my writing style. But yeah, I mean, yours sounds like you've got it down, what you're going for, you've got it down. Now, I did read a little bit of the first chapter, and yeah, it's got that old hard-boiled detective vibe to it, and I like those kind of stories, like the movies especially.
Yeah, strong narrative voice.
Yeah, and it's worth reading, listeners, so get out there and check that out. We'll get back to that book here in a little bit, but I find that interesting.
You want to roll another commercial?
Sure.
This one would be There Must Be Something in the Water, which is Abigail Hugini is going to be our guest next week. So pay attention.
Pay attention.
A small rural community in the Lowcountry along Ocean Highway, Green Pine, South Carolina, has long lacked cultural and educational opportunities for its young people's future success. Many have gone on to serve in the highest levels of education, government, public service, elected office, business, and medicine. With so much success against the odds, surely there must be something in the water. Abigail Hugini chronicles the impact just 42 of Green Pond's children have gone on to make in the world. All full-color editions include photos from around town and local translations of down-home fame. These inspirational stories prove that, regardless of one's background, we can all find our own path toward greatness. An excellent reference, keepsake, gift, and addition to every library, There Must Be Something in the Water, anthology of the fourth generation, descendants of Green Pond, after the emancipation, is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group.
Now, you heard the commercial mention that's in full color. It's also an oversized book. It's like 9 by 12 inches, I think, and it's a beautiful laminate hardcover or a softcover edition. And that book, like I said before, I thought it was going to be probably regionally popular, and it's proving to be popular all across North America. She has been holding events and literally ordering books by the thousands of dollars at a time. In fact, two more shipments are going out this week for totaling over $5,000 worth of books. And I'm still writing royalty checks for sales through Amazon and other Barnes & Noble and all the retailer outlets and stuff. And her royalty checks are running into the thousands of dollars. So for what I thought would be a regional book, this one has done very well. And we're finding that she's getting a lot of great feedback. It's very inspirational to a lot of people, especially younger African Americans who can see what a lot of people who look like them have gone on to accomplish, and maybe it's something they can do too. So we're really proud of this book. We're proud of Abigail Hugini, who put it together, and I was wrong when I said next week. Next week we've got Aichen Chang Lim. She's going to be the week after. So 2 weeks from now we're going to have Abigail Hugini on. She's the wife of the president of Alabama A&M University, Andrew Hugini Jr., and she's going to talk about this book and what went into it, and we look forward to having you all back for that, because it's going to be very fascinating. Go check out that video on YouTube.
Yeah, we do have a couple more comments here on Twitter. Verwayne Greenhall, he's, you know, touting that he was a guest on this program, Lucky Show number 13, but I wasn't sure how great I was. But life is a game, and I love to play.
Yeah,
you were fantastic, Verwayne. Every week that you're here, you participate, and we love you. So
yeah, we send it to all the guests in advance of the show with a little "Don't let this happen to you" note.
Yeah, Robert. No, we're just kidding, Verwayne.
Yeah, obviously.
Yeah, Robert G. Willis-Croft. Here's something. Ed Offley, who wrote the forewords to Operation Ivy Bells and Operation Icebreaker, took 25 years to write and publish his landmark book, Scorpion Down. the story of the Navy's cover-up of the actual reasons we lost the submarine Scorpion. So there you go, 25 years.
Wow. Jeez. And I wonder how much of that time he spent looking over his shoulder, too, getting ready to reveal some stuff. Because he revealed a lot of stuff in that book and ruffled a few feathers, no doubt. But, that's 25 years. Thanks for the comment, Robert. That's it gives us some perspective. Me, I write my books while I'm watching TV, usually during the commercials. So that's why it takes me like a whole week to get a book done, you know.
Yeah. So what's your writing process like, James? Do you have a specific time or like you're going to write 1,000 words today? Do you write at 2 o'clock in the morning, 2 o'clock in the afternoon?
Early morning, that's the best. I actually used to like going into the office because, I'd wake up at 5:30. I'd be at the office an hour early and I knew that I had an hour uninterrupted time to write, and just the morning always seemed to be the best time for me. By 3 p.m. I'm a different person with a different brain, so it's got to be early in the morning.
Well, when you come in that early, I will wave to you on my way to bed.
That's the truth.
Exactly.
Too.
That's when it's the best.
There's no doubt. People get emails from me at 3, 4, 5, 6 in the morning.
Doing,
he's still working.
Doing fresh ink work.
Oh.
Yep.
These night owls.
So where do you get your story ideas from?
Story ideas. One of the things I wanted to try to make kind of novel about Dancing in the Trap was, Chandler and Ross McDonald, their detectives were so rooted in the cities that they were in. All Raymond Chandler's took place in Hollywood, Los Angeles, and Ross McDonald had the fictional city of Santa Teresa, which is, probably San Francisco or somewhere around there. And the detectives always like, they know the police and they know the streets and they have informants, and those things really aided them. And so what I wanted to do was kind of turn it a little bit on its head and take my detective-like character, he's not a detective, he's a former merchant marine, Mickey Fairfax, and plop him in a situation where he didn't know the streets or even the language sometimes. And so the first book, Dancing in the Trap, takes place primarily in Paris. And so I read a lot of travel books. I just had a couple Baedekers, and I went through those and got ideas for locations that I wanted to use, and things that came up reading about the culture that I wanted to use, brands of cigarettes and things like that. And before I knew it, I had story points, and the story just kind of fell into place.
Well, it sounds like you're a bit of an outliner.
Yeah, I think I am. I think I like to outline. I don't like to plan too much because I like the flow. And the story did change over time. Originally, it was going to be two girls each blackmailing each other's fathers. And I decided I didn't want to write women in that way. That, I really made it, I don't think my novel is woke by any stretch of the imagination, but there were things that I did on purpose that I saw as being, portraying women in a negative light, or mistakes that kind of crime writers in that same vein have made in the past. And of course, you're looking back on something that was written 80 years ago, and the morality of it and the political correctness of it are always going to fall into question. So I just didn't want to have those same pitfalls where, the guy was incredibly violent and, God's gift to women, which, is sort of a toxic masculinity that pervades the genre. So I specifically didn't want to have that. My guy's a lot more modest, kind of real character. I saw the story going in a way that could be perceived as very negative towards women. So I nipped it in the butt and changed the story. And I was happy with the way that it turned out.
So you like the way you've portrayed your dames now, huh?
Yeah, you can still call them dames, but, they got to be a little more than one-dimensional.
A little bit, yeah.
Yeah, and like the detective characters, the ones that are kind of, they're smart, but they're a bit of a schlub. I think those are the more interesting ones because they got the flaws and, you know, it's not they're the guy that's on the ball on everything and everybody else around him is flawed and messed up. It's, you know, that's the main character's the flawed one. I've read some stories and seen the movies that, you know, those are the kind of detectives I think that are really, you know, kind of cool because they show you that they're human and whatnot.
Well, very much. I hate the heroes where the odds have to be overwhelming because they're just the toughest, smartest person to ever live. You know, like no less than three guys are going to take down Jason Bourne, and you know he knows everything before you know it. And you know that's you know it takes one set of sensibilities to write that way. But I mean, I didn't want to write that way. I don't know anybody like that.
Yeah, you know,
wanted it to be sort of your average man feeling his way in the dark for the solution to these problems.
Yeah, I think a good example of that is like the way Sean Connery played James Bond. You know, he was this suave guy and, you know, goes and whacks a guy, kills a guy, and then goes and has a martini, shaking, not stirring, and goes off with a hot woman up to his hotel room. Now you got Daniel Craig playing that, and this guy's an alcoholic because he's killed people, and it's messing with his conscience, with his soul, and this guy is damaged. That's the Bond that I prefer. Daniel Craig to me is the
–
and I was a huge Connery fan, but Daniel Craig is the guy. He's Bond.
Hmm. Oh, he surpassed everybody else. I even think, you know, Pierce Brosnan was, you know, everyone was saying he was so much better a Bond than Sean Connery, but Daniel Craig has put it so far beyond anyone's reach that it's going to be a long time before I think we have a Bond that was that compelling.
Hmm. I agree.
Yeah. Now, Go ahead.
They did the same thing with Batman early, if you saw, like, you know, portraying Batman as kind of having these cumulative injuries where, you know, he wasn't able to do the things physically that he could as a younger man. I found that was compelling as well.
Christian Bale is Batman. He was my favorite Batman.
Yeah.
He wasn't the cartoonish, you know, one that, like Michael Keaton, I thought was cartoonish.
I went last weekend to see comedian Bill Maher, who also has his own show on HBO. He appeared in Birmingham, and he talked about James Bond. And kind of made fun of Daniel Craig. He didn't use the word wussified, but one that rhymes with wussified. He said they've really wussified him because now he goes out to fight the bad guys. He takes his girlfriend with him, and in this movie, he takes her kid. So, but that humanizes him, you know, instead of it just being a cliche kind of a character. It's somebody who's real and really has to deal with relationships and things going on in his life. But I think that evolution has been especially true with women. Particularly in movies and TV shows, because for a long time there, for like probably at least 10 years, if you had a woman who was in charge of solving the crime and, you know, or heading up the SWAT team or whatever it was, half the story seemed to be overcoming the impediment of what people think she can and can't do because she's a woman. And honestly, that got a little bit old to me after a while, and I got kind of turned off by those kind of stories. You don't see that much anymore. You just turn on a TV show like, you know, an FBI or something like that. You got women agents running things, and there's none of this, oh, I'm a woman, and this is important to think about. It's not. They're just doing the job just like any man would. And I think that's been a big evolution in storytelling and crime solving and who does that kind of stuff. For a long time, it was pretty much only men. And, you know, then you start getting your Angela Lansbury's and A Murder, She Wrote, things like that, where other people can solve crimes, even if they happen to be a woman. So it's interesting to see that evolution, and I'm not enough into that genre to see it all, but I've been noticing that much. It's not so much about being a woman anymore. It's about a woman just taking charge and getting the job done.
Yeah.
I think there are a ton of awesome women writers right now, and they've really, I think, taken over the mystery genre. You know, there's still guys who pervade the more suspense thrillers and the Tom Clancy and like spy game kind of novels. But like the mystery genre, I think, has been completely taken over by women writers. And
definitely.
You know, all due respect to them, they're killing it. And even down to like the cozies where you get with like MC Beaton and Cleo Coyle, they just, and I think McKinley is another one, they've taken the cozy mystery and really made it something worth reading, where I never really liked those, like thinking back to like Ellery Queen, which I thought was like really, really soft mysteries, or there wasn't like a great level of violence. There wasn't like a great real threat level. It was almost like to Nancy Drew proportions. But these newer writers who are writing these cozies, like, you know, MC Beaton with Hamish Macbeth and the Agatha Raisin series, like, those are really, really good books. They're fun and they're funny and they have good mystery to them.
Great. You want to run another ad, Beam?
Sure. Why not?
All right. We're up to Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy. And listeners, this is one of two books right now that we have out there that's not only selling like gangbusters, but we are selling more hardcovers than softcovers. They're fairly similar numbers. I mean, you know, it might be like 1,200 hardcovers and 1,100 softcovers. It's not like there's a big gap, but it is actually a bigger number on the hardcovers. And I've never seen that until this year. So Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy.
So what is it that these gangbusters sell, and how can I get some?
Every person has a private life and a secret self. This is true of those we know and people we only know because they are famous. Discover fascinating, intimate, clever, witty, poignant, insightful tales from a diverse roster of notable women who dare reveal both the unknown and the previously undisclosed. But these are not gossipy tales. No, they are personal, anecdotal, always meaningful stories for quiet reading, sharing aloud, even performing from the stage. Compiled by Detroit playwright Jay Ajluni, Whoopi Likes Her Bacon Crispy, 65 fascinating excerpts from the memoirs of famous and infamous women, is illustrated with whimsical portraits that capture these remarkable celebrities at their best. Choose your own from laminate hardcover, softback, and digital editions, all proudly published by Fresh Ink Group. Come away with a richer appreciation of these talented women and smile for permitting them to entertain you in unexpected and delightful ways.
Hi.
That's a very cool animated video over on YouTube. Go check it out.
Yeah, over on Twitter, there's a couple of comments. Verwayne is chiming in. He says, how does that old saying go? Only my mama loves me, but she could be lying too. Robert G. Willis Cross says, toxic masculinity. You're kidding, right? I'm with you there, Robert. All right, so go ahead, Stephen.
I'm interested in the cartoon pilot
that James talked about mentioning
earlier. What's going on with that?
Oh, you know, a long, long time ago, my brother moved from Texas to California, trying to do the acting thing, and one of the guys he was in an acting class with was pitching a cartoon series to both Cartoon Network and Comedy Central, and he had everything. He had the front credits of the show done, and it looked great, and he had the characters, and he had their backstory. He had everything but a script. So my brother came to me and he said, you know, my friend is pitching this cartoon series, and, you know, he's got everything but a script. So in 2 days, we pulled a Sylvester Stallone and, like, locked ourselves in his apartment, and in 2 days we wrote a script for this cartoon series that we had no other dealings with, and gave it to him. It didn't wind up becoming anything. I don't know if he pitched our script or not, but that was an experience. And, you know, my brother came home and he was doing a lot of student independent films here. And I remember him bringing home the script for Where the Heart Is. The movie had, like, Natalie Portman and some other people in it.
I remember that movie.
And he actually read for Miss Congeniality. And I remember he came home and he said, like, you know, I think I might have this part, and it's a really good part. It winds up being the killer. And then they rewrote the part and put, I think, Laurie Metcalf. I think they wound up being the killer in that. I never saw that movie. But, you know, they'd rewritten the part, like, in the last few weeks. But that was Office Space was another one that he, like, read for. So it was during this time, like, in the 90s, where, like, Austin film industry was really, really heating up. And so, like, yeah, he would come home with these scripts, and it was really inspirational for me to read those and see the process. And that was an exciting time in Austin.
Cool. So what was this cartoon about?
It was a cartoon called Out of Hand, and I think you can still see the trailer on YouTube. And it was a game show for cartoons, and we just came up with a script where we were going to put these characters as random characters, sort of like in a Wipeout like situation where they just had to do all these things that they were not physically built to do. So it was there was a lot of gags in there, a lot of sight gags and things that I think were going to be very easily translated. I was really hoping that series would get picked up, because the guy had done a lot of world building, I guess is the word you'd use now. So even though he didn't have a script, you know, he had these really fully fleshed out characters, and you know, there's a love triangle and all these things with the characters on that show. So it was neat. Again, it's called Out of Hand. I would absolutely recommend looking up the trailer on YouTube, because it's really funny and really well done.
Yeah, I'm only seeing one on YouTube, and it's titled Keller Teenage Wasteland Out of Hand Trailer. That doesn't sound like it.
That might be it.
Okay. That was 10 years ago.
Oh, gosh, that was probably
and,
20 years ago.
And it's on a channel called Gay-Themed Movies. That's not right?
I cannot say that is it. That's not okay. The gentleman's name who was pitching it.
Okay.
I don't know.
All right. And there's one called Out of My Hand Trailer, and that was at the 2015 LA Film Festival. I'll have to hunt around a little bit more. Yeah, I'm interested
sometimes
in seeing that.
Deep search. Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, take a deep dive.
We're up to that time where we're going to talk about his book, Dancing in the Trap. You want to go ahead and run the Hello Chattanooga ad to wrap up our ads for today, and then we'll come back and talk to James about this book. Listeners, this is the other book that the hardcover is outselling the softcover right now, although they're both moving at a very brisk clip. And this one, 712 pages in full color, selling for $44 for the hardcover. And they're selling as fast as they can print them.
Hello, Chattanooga. Famous people who have visited the Tennessee Valley. Features photos, stories, and complete listings of the entertainers, athletes, political leaders, and others who visited the area since 1900. Chattanooga has attracted some of the best-known celebrities in the world, thanks to our city's historic venues, beautiful scenery, and powerful people. Hello Chattanooga features hundreds of restored photos, behind-the-scenes stories, and thousands of fully indexed entries spanning more than 700 pages. I'm David Carroll. I've worked in Chattanooga television and radio for more than 40 years. I also write a weekly newspaper column and have written two other books, Chattanooga Radio and Television, A Photo History of Chattanooga Media, and Volunteer Bama Dog, A TV Guy's Love Letter to the South, a collection of my most popular stories. Hello Chattanooga is proudly published by Fresh Ink Group in a keepsake, jacketed, hardcover edition with full-color interior printing, softcover with black and white photos, and all-color ebook formats worldwide. Take a trip back in time, enjoy great memories, and maybe even settle an argument as you learn the dates and places that your favorite star, athlete, or president visited the Chattanooga area.
Cool
yeah,
book,
that's
Bean.
A really cool book. Yeah, definitely a cool book. I did a little bit of work on it, and man, this thing is loaded with pictures. It's a who's who, everybody that ever played down in music, politicians, sports people, whoever played or passed through Chattanooga.
Little
it's
Debbie.
All documented. Just really cool. So, yeah.
So, James, let's talk about your novel, Dancing in the Trap. This is book one of the Mickey Fairfax novels. What I've read of it, I like the fact that you've tried to take the Raymond Chandler, Ross McDonald conceit, but instead of having your person be identified, you know, with a particular place like L.A. or Santa Teresa in the case of Ross McDonald's character, you've decided to do the fish out of water kind of story. What's your thinking behind that? And tell us how you did that.
Oh, well, it was just an effort to kind of take what was established as that detective genre and find something to tweak it. So if you're writing genre fiction to begin with, you have these set of rules that you know you're going to use. But, you know, in having those rules, that gives you the opportunity to turn one or two of them on their head and try to put your own thumbprint on something. So, that was something that I thought would be kind of advantageous for me, too, to do it, because I wouldn't have to know what a detective who's been in L.A. for 40 years would know. And I don't even know how you would come across that knowledge. So I thought it was almost going to be easier to write a situation where I didn't know exactly like the character. Like we're both completely unawares of what's going on around us and sort of, again, like having to kind of feel our way around. So as much as I could hope to glean from travel books is probably all I could expect the character to know in that situation, and then just kind of writing it very organically in very linear fashion from beginning to end with a real, you know, now what would you do kind of mentality going forward. And plus, I mean, I wanted to write something that was not a travel book, but had that element to it. I love the old Agatha Christie novels, like, you know, Death on the Nile or, you know, Murder in Mesopotamia. They took you to these incredible places. And that's why I read. I mean, that's why I read. My favorite thing about reading is, you know, seeing these other places kind of through the author's eyes and learning about cultures and, you know, little things like, you know, how a Frenchman orders a drink or, you know, curse words, which I had to Google. But those kind of things are great. So, I mean, I wouldn't want to pitch it as like, oh, it's a, you know, Sam Spade meets Rick Steves, but in a way, you know, it kind of is, because each book is going to take him to another incredible place. You know, book two, he's going to Tenerife, and then I've already got, you know, the third book planned out. He's going to go to Belgium and probably spill into Luxembourg while we're there. But those are places that I want to go, and those are places I want to see. So Mickey's just getting to do that before me.
Hmm. Yeah, so now I'm kind of curious, what sort of research do you do? I mean, if you've never been to Paris, and you know, is it just travel books, as you mentioned, or do you get into, you know, get on the internet and start digging deep on what, you know, French life is about?
I didn't want to just do a deep dive on the internet, because I kind of think you start getting the same information. There's so many outlets that are regurgitating information from one place. You know, you go to four travel sites and you see the exact same information. It's like they almost just copied it from some set source. So I really tried to stick with one guidebook I have in particular, just so there would be some sort of kind of continuity, I think. When I was kind of jumping around between four or five travel books, it started getting to be a little much. That's why I was very grateful for Tenerife, the second book. I mean, it's a small island. I feel like I know the whole place backwards and forwards now. You know, for the last year writing this book, or year and a half. But with Paris, I mean, gosh, you could spend all day and you could spend, you know, 10 bucks and not hit on everything there is to hit on in that city. So it really, they were just sort of accoutrements to what was going on, but also kind of little things became inspirations for, I wouldn't say the story, but for bits, you know, for bits of the story and for jokes or, you know, things like that. But it just sort of happened organically. But I didn't want to over research it, because again, that's just not who I am. I'm never going to write the most researched book ever. My books are fun, and they're light, and they're fast, and I just wanted to keep it that way.
Now, you know, if you travel to some of these places that you're going to be writing about, business expense, you know, you got to do the research for the book, right?
Exactly. So
and
was,
I used to be a master at that. Back in the days when I would travel around the world and scuba dive with a friend of mine, I'd just have one of my guys say, hey, book me some kind of a video shoot or something in this country. And he'd come back with, okay, here's a little TV commercial. While you're there, you got to take 15 minutes and get some shots of so-and-so. Bam, whole trip's now a business expense. It's amazing how that can work.
So, James, you know, tell us a little about the character, your main character here. He's like a Boy Scout above board.
The other thing I wanted to really look into is, you know, you read these you read these great books about these detectives, and they always seem to have this unfailing moral compass, and they never really get into why that is. And a lot of books sort of follow the same kind of trope with their main character. You know, their hero is usually an ex-cop, which is very useful because, you know, him being a police officer to begin with, you know, he has this this want of justice and law and order. But the fact that he's been kicked off the force or he's no longer a cop means that it kind of tells you that, you know, he has a better compass than this institution, that institutions can become corrupt, and that there is a law that is higher than the law of man, and that's kind of what he is ascribing to. So, again, it's a very fruitful thing to have an ex-cop, ex-military, who's not doing those things anymore for some moral reason that sets him up as this kind of paragon of virtue. But I thought I wanted to explore it in a different way. So I wanted him to have, you know, the Judeo-Christian ethics and don't kill, don't steal. But I didn't want him to be colored by prejudice. So I really thought about, like, where prejudice came from or comes from. And, you know, I hate to say it, probably comes from your parents. So I didn't want him to have parents. So he became an orphan. So Mickey Fairfax grows up in an orphanage, raised by nuns. I'm like, on paper, he should have this kind of ideal moral compass. He's raised by these loving nuns in this Judeo-Christian ethic, and he doesn't have parents to mess up his head. Not that my parents messed up my head. They're beautiful people, but I just had to explore again where those things, where those ideas come from, if I really wanted him to be unprejudiced. And then I wanted him to be worldly, but not super educated. So making him a merchant marine just kind of fit that bill. And that also, you know, gives him a little bit of toughness, gives him a little bit of edge. He's seen the world, but he's not of the world. And so it just made it kind of perfect for this guy that's going to be, you know, scampering around the globe, you know, putting out fires.
Yeah, these days you're going to have to, what, you know, to use another cliche, break the mold. You've got to get out of the stereotypes. You've got to give people characters that are different than they expect, and maybe even more human than a lot of the stereotypical characters of the past. I think of, you know, like our author Mark Marlowe. His hero in there is a Korean fellow who's every bit the anti-hero. Or you get like Robert Willis Cross, Mac McDowell. You know, he's a Cold War submarine maven who's very masculine, very manly, very Navy. But he's also breaks out that mold, and he's got the soft side, and he's got a great relationship with people in his life and all that. So that's what people really like. It's, you know, they, even if it's that tough guy, masculine superhero type, they still like to have that human side too, because that's what they relate to.
Yeah, humanity.
I agree more.
Now, over on Twitter, Verwayne added another comment. He says, I think a cartoon series would appeal to kids, but having enough adult jokes between the lines would be very popular. Yeah, I agree with that. That's, in fact, that's kind of becoming a trend. Like Seth MacFarlane is great at that. He put out a cartoon series like Family Guy, and half the stuff in it is what kids like, and half the stuff in it, you got to be pretty much grown in order to even understand what the joke was.
The Simpsons. They've always been like that.
Even things like Pixar movies. You know, they're putting those little Easter eggs for adults, scattering them here and there just to keep the adults interested too, even though the adults are looking at each other and shaking their head and thinking, well, the 9-year-olds didn't catch that, but they weren't supposed to, you know? So, yeah, it's a cool thought. So, James, do you have anything out there that's promoting the book? Like if you got a book trailer on YouTube or, a blog posting or something like that where people can go check out more, or should they just check the retailers like Amazon?
I put out a trailer, just one that I put together myself, a short clips from the audiobook. Put that on Instagram, which is probably the only way to really connect with me. At James M. Welpley is my Instagram handle. If you're an aspiring writer, another self-published writer, reach out to me. I will get back to you. I love talking shop. I could do it all day. That's the best way to get to me, and that's kind of the only way I'm promoting right now. I was very much hoping, I'm going to say something right here that's going to sound like sour grapes, so I'm going to say it anyway. I was really hoping when I got onto Instagram, it was going to be this great grassroots campaigning platform for, you know, self-published writers and indie authors. what I'm finding with most of the bookstagrammers, the ones that are hugely successful that have, like, you know, thousands of followers, they're touting the same 10 books that are right in the front door when you walk into any bookstore. You know, they get books directly from the company, and those are the ones that they're reviewing. And, you know, they got their own gig, and that's their gig. And I had a very frank conversation with one who a bookstagrammer who had a massive following. She was nice enough to sit down and talk to me about it. And she's like, you know, yeah, I get the books from the company, and yeah, I get a box a month, and those are the books I have to review. And she said, I can't review any independent or self-published people, because not only, you know, the time frame of having to get all these books reviewed by a month, she said, I have to review the books that my people are going to read. So, you know, the Instagram, a lot of it, the books being touted are the same ones that are on Oprah's book list and Reese Witherspoon, who are the last people that need, you know, more publicity. Or more touting of their books. So I really, really thank the reviewers, the bookstagrammers who do promote self-published and, you know, not the heavy heavies of the book world. The few that I've gotten reviews from, I will remember them forever and ever, because they took a chance on reading a book that they didn't know anything about and that 90 other people hadn't read and already reviewed. And, you know, reviews have been good. I've sent out a lot more books to bookstagrammers than reviews that I've gotten, but, you know, it takes time. I know I'm on the bottom of a bunch of TBRs. Like, everybody's got an overgrowing TBR.
Everybody's got
never
know
what that thing's going to be. But, yeah, I thank them. Thank the couple of reviewers that have taken the time to read and review my book. They've been great. And I just challenge any bookstagrammers out there, like, think of it this way. Think what it would mean for you if you found the next big writer. And, you know, again, everybody can walk into a Barnes & Noble or a bookstore, and you're going to see those 20 books that they put up front. And, yeah, those are the same books that are reviewed ad nauseum on Instagram. But think what it would do for you. You found the next you know, Finley Donovan is killing it, or, you know, Riley Seeger, or, you know, one of these other authors that, you know, are really huge right now. So that's my challenge to the Instagram universe and the bookstagrammers out there. Like, I know you got your own gig, but, you know, every once in a while, reach on the dust of your bookshelf and pull one out and be a kingmaker.
There you go.
Yeah, because there's a whole lot of really good, talented indie authors out there. Steven and I, we promote a lot of them. That's why we bring them a lot of them on this show, because they're good writers that, you know, we tend to get overlooked. Now, have you put your book on BookBub?
I have not. I've just been doing the Amazon thing, and again,
BookBub.com. It's a site. They got one account that's set up just for readers, and then one account that's set up just for authors. So you got a whole audience there that's readers, and you might find, you know, and there's thousands of people on that site. And I've been on it for, I don't know, about 2 months, and I've gotten a few new reviews through that site. So that's kind of cool. You know, hopefully that grows a little more, but bookbub.com. Book, B-U-B.
I'll have to look into that.
Yeah.
When I started promoting the book on Instagram, I just started, you know, with these hashtags, like, you know, mystery thriller, and I wound up getting this gigantic response from the UK. And I don't know if there are just more mystery readers there, more people following those hashtags there, but, you know, I looked at my results of what kind of traffic my ads on Instagram are getting, and like 90% of it would be in the UK. And I'm thinking, how's that helping me, you know, selling books here? Of course, you can buy my book on Amazon.UK and Amazon.ca for Canada. But, yeah, I was getting a tremendous amount of traffic from my Instagram ads from the UK and from Canada.
So when you self-published, did you work with a publisher at all? How did you get your cover? How did this all come together? How did you make it happen?
I made the cover myself on Canva. And yeah, you know, Amazon made it so ridiculously easy to publish that book that if that would have been available 20 years ago, I probably wouldn't have taken me this long to finish that book. So it was an amazingly easy process. The audiobook was an amazingly easy process. You used the AXC, which is like a branch of a liaison between Amazon and Audible. Found an awesome narrator, a guy named Michael Moore, who read the book for me. I tried to record it myself.
Is that ACX you're talking about?
ACX, yes, sir.
Yeah. Okay. I thought you said AXZ or something like that.
I may have.
Yeah.
You going to call me out on Kurt Vonnegut Jr. and the selective dyslexia for ACX?
Yeah, there you go. we're persnickety.
I laughed when you said that word. That's my word.
So, James, what do you have coming up next? What's in the pipe? In the pipeline?
Tenerife, book two, Tenerife should be, I'm still shining it up. It should be available in February. I've got the cover's done. Again, I did the cover on, I think, using two programs. I used Wamba for the cover art, and then I put the cover physically together on Canva, which are great tools for writers. I had a good story about book covers here. You know, I did the original Dancing in the Trap book cover, the blue cover, which is on most of the stuff now. But I also went back and I realized on my bookshelf, I didn't have any books that were that size. All the books I have, all my favorite books, are all 4x7s, right? Like tiny little ones you can stick in your back pocket. So I'm like, why don't I just make a 4x7 copy and put like a kind of pulp kind of cover on it? So I found a guy on Instagram, Robert Miller, at Rob C. Miller Collage, I think it's his Instagram handle. And he put together like a cool pulp, old school, old Hollywood style cover for me. And then I printed that on Amazon again. In a 4x7 tiny little copy that, again, you could stick in your back pocket. On my Instagram feed, you can see I actually have it sticking in my back pocket. So, like, yeah, all the Kurt Vonnegut Juniors I used to read, and all my McDonald's and Chandler's and Hammett's, they're all that size. And it was just funny when I put my book down next to all these great books that I loved, and my book was enormous compared to them. It just didn't make any sense. But, you know, that's how big books are now, and I guess that's how it's going to stay.
Okay, so we do have a phone caller. You want to take this call here?
Go.
All right. Hello, caller. Welcome to the show. You are on the air. What is your name and where are you calling from?
This is Robert Williscroft calling you from Denver.
Hi, right. Robert Williscroft.
We hear it's cold
to the show.
Out there.
Yeah, I called up because this is easier to do by voice than by a tweet. When I first was marketing Operation Ivy Bells, I used BookBub in a special way. They have a process where you can pay them, and I paid them a roughly $550, and I lowered the price of the book to 99 cents, and they accepted it. And they marketed it, and I sold 15,000 books.
Wow.
Now, I tried to get my other books onto BookBub, and never again was I able to get them to accept a book the way they accepted Operation Ivy Bells. But it certainly doesn't hurt to try. They don't charge you unless they actually take you, so you just kind of have the money on the back burner until they take you.
Good to know.
Yeah. I have to try that.
Yeah.
I would love to sell 15,000 copies of a book.
Yeah, definitely.
It has allowed me to talk about Operation Ivy Bells as a bestseller ever since.
Yeah. That's cool.
Nice.
That's always a good point there.
Well, thanks a lot,
Robert.
That's some good advice.
Yeah, you're very welcome.
All right, take care.
So, James, we're winding down on our time here. We did want to ask you, you got kind of a soft spot for old books, old movies, into the nostalgia?
Oh, yeah. I you know, the things that I love to read, I don't think anything's been published past about 1958. So I really, you know, in my books, I don't specify when they're taking place. I don't make any references to computers or cell phones. There will never be a cell phone in anything that I write. Not that I'm like a complete technophobe, but just I think they lack a timelessness and they lack a romance to me, and I can leave it without. So it's kind of funny when my writers group reads anything of mine, you know, one person will think that it's taking place in like the 50s and another it takes place in the 70s. I think I make some reference to Cher. I know that I do.
That covers 70 years.
That kind of dates it. But, you know, I never intended it to feel like it was, you know, taking place in like the 30s or 40s, but I do just make very conscious omissions of certain technology in an effort to kind of keep it give it a more timeless feel.
Yeah, that's cool. A lot of the stuff that I write, especially the short stories, I mean, they take place in the era when we didn't have all this computer technology and all that stuff, just a simpler time. But it could be like my novel Jazz Baby, that's 1925. And then what I'm working on now is 1977. So, you know, it's all over the board.
It's like traveling to another place.
Yeah, that's the cool thing about reading is you want to travel, whether it's time travel or traveling to Paris. It's you want to read and get lost in that and travel.
Absolutely.
Tell us about any perils that you faced with the self-publishing, literary agents, the kinds of books that get published, you know, the influence of Amazon. Have you run into any kind of issues or learned something that people can use?
Again, it's more sour grapes. You know, I feel like Amazon's been great for being able to publish you know, smaller authors and indie authors than me just having a book to begin with. But, you know, I worry about, like, the algorithms, because algorithms, after a while, any mathematician, I think, will tell you, they start to prove themselves. So if you've got books, you know, that are selling that are all about, you know, boy wizards and sexy vampires, the algorithm's going to suggest you more books about boy wizards and sexy vampires, and then all that anyone's going to think that anyone's reading is books about boy wizards and sexy vampires. Before you know it, that's what anyone's going to be writing. That's what all the literary agents are going to be after, and it's going to be like this self-fulfilling prophecy. So, which is all the more reason that we're dependent on people who read these things critically and who review books, that we need to get a greater variety of stories and things out there. And, you know, that might sound silly from a person who writes, you know, very, very kind of literal genre fiction like I do. They're like, well, we don't need any more private detective stories either. We want our boy wizards and sexy vampires. But that's just the thing that I fear. That's the thing that I fear. I fear the algorithm will start to prove itself, and then we're going to get one story. Like, eventually someone's going to write the ultimate story with the ultimate character, and then there's just going to be 900 copies of that.
Hmm. Yeah.
So, James, this has been a hoot. Definitely getting to know you and learn more about your first book and the second book that's on its way. Do you have any advice to authors out there who are listening?
Not selling your first book is not a bad thing. Just from a business standpoint, you may only get one shot at a consumer. And it would be a good thing for you to have at least three books ready when you do get that shot. So maybe you don't publish the first book you write. Maybe you wait until you got three kind of ready to go and you publish them, because readers are voracious and they're going to read everything. So if you do get a shot at that one consumer, you want to make sure that you've got more than one book.
Capture him too. Yeah, get that email address. Get him on a newsletter list or something so that you can come back to him.
Yeah, hey, that's business stuff that I don't even have a head for yet. I'm just, I'm a guy telling stories, trying to sell a book. So I think, Beam asked me when we were on our first call, like, what what was the goal, you know, in writing. And I think really it is just to have that person you don't know come up and tell you they read your book and they liked it. Like that would be it for me.
That's one of the greatest experiences
on
right
Amazon.
There.
Yeah, I can't wait for that.
I remember years ago, right after Jazz Baby came out, this is 10 years ago, Jazz Baby's celebrating 10 years this year. I remember getting our former manager, Ann Stewart, she passed away, but she sent me this email that came from this girl in Ireland. And she sent the email to Fresh Ink Group, and she had this email. She talked about she had just bought my book, Jazz Baby, and she sat down in the afternoon to read it. You know, she was just going to read a chapter or two. And she said next thing she knew, it was close to midnight, and she was finished with it, and she just wanted to tell me how much she enjoyed it. And that blew me away. This is something I wrote, and some girl in Ireland is reading this. That's, you know, and still, when you get those reviews and people, you know, tell you whether they enjoyed it or not, that's still one of the greatest thrills, you know, for a writer. And it'll never get boring and tiring.
Mm-hmm. So, James, how do people find you if somebody wants to get a hold of you? Now, they can always go to freshinkgroup.com where we have a contact form, leave you a note, and we'll make sure we pass it along. But how do they find you directly?
Instagram's going to be the best way. Again, at James M. Welpley. That's the best way. I will return any message I get. And, yeah, again, if someone's just wants to talk to another author starting out about anything under the sun, I am absolutely available and willing. So, yeah, hit me up.
All right,
you
cool.
Let me throw this in. You got to get on Twitter, seriously, because there's a big audience out there that don't do the Instagram thing, and then there's the Instagrammers that don't do the Twitter thing. Cross over.
Twitter, Twitter is where hashtags can really, really work for you.
They have hashtag writer's lift, and people will, hey, I'm going to do a writer's lift. Put the link to your book right here, right now, and boom, you'll sell a couple copies.
Yeah.
I will be on Twitter by the end of the week.
Cool. So, everybody, the author is James Welpley. His first book in the Mickey Fairfax novel series is Dancing in the Trap. It's out there for sale now. Make sure you pick up your copy and send a note to James and spread the word and get some people to come listen to this podcast in the archives so more people can learn about him and his work. It's
and
been a treat having
you
on, James. Yeah, always review it and subscribe every time you go look at things. So, again, thanks for coming on the show, James. It's been a lot of fun getting to know you.
Thanks, James.
Thanks for having me, guys. This is awesome.
So, Beam, who have we got next week?
Next week, February 2nd, we've got Aichen Chang Lim. She is an author and a all-around interesting person, so tune in for that one. I got the old show I used to do. I think I interviewed her a time or two, so this will be fun catching up with her.
Yep, and then as I mentioned earlier, after that, on February 9th, our 80th episode, 80 weeks into this mess, is Abigail Hugini, the author of There Must Be Something in the Water, about the descendants of the emancipated slaves and going on and accomplishing great things and being an inspiration to others. That's Abigail Hugini. She'll be here 2 weeks from tonight.
And February 16th, episode 81, that's Carlisle Toms. He's a return guest. He's been on before. He's an author and a podcaster and all-around interesting individual as well. So tune in for that one.
And then get your listening ears going, because the week after that, February 23rd, we've got episode 82 featuring musician Frankie Ray. She's a singer, songwriter, guitar player from the Tampa area. She's down there tearing it up. We've looked at her calendar. She's doing 6-7 shows a week, just spreading it around. And she's got some very cool music. So we're excited to have her on the show. We're going to listen to some of her music. We're going to talk to Frankie and get to know more about her.
Yes, indeed. And March 2nd, we are going to have an author from Australia. G'day there.
Hi.
A.K. Aulis. He's a writer, and we're going to find out a little bit more about him living on the other side of the world. Interesting thing about that, when I'm creating this show, it's 8 p.m. here where I'm at when the show starts in Michigan on Wednesday evening. And it's going to be 9 a.m. Thursday morning when he gets up to do this show on that day on March 2nd. So that's going to be kind of interesting.
Yeah,
A.K. Aulis, episode 83 on March 2nd. Tune in.
And remember, everybody, subscribe to that newsletter. If you're already getting the newsletter, forward it to people. Tell them, hey, check this out. Subscribe to it. And while you're at it, click on that link. Check out the podcast. So, everybody, our guest tonight again was James Welpley. His book is Dancing in the Trap. It's been a great pleasure having him on. And we want you to get out there and check him out, check his work out, and help us spread the word. Thanks again for coming on, James.
Thanks, James.
Hey, thank you, guys.
All right. Take care.
Everybody.
See you all next week.
We will catch you next week.
You've been a part of Voice of Indy, a production of Fresh Ink Group. Spread the word, support our guests, then find us at freshinkgroup.com and be sure to hashtag Fresh Ink Group.